is without sin past the first cell phone. So I'm going to turn off my cell phone just to set a good example for everybody else. It doesn't want to go off. So welcome to tonight's special lecture, sponsored by the Max Weinreich Center at YIVO. Ordinarily, in the evenings, we have lectures by research fellows, people who are here on fellowships, but Dr. Max Cohen has graciously agreed to lecture without the benefit of a research fellowship. Let me just tell you a little about Dr. Cohen. He was born in 1951 in Paris. He's a psychoanalyst. He lectures at the University of Paris 7. He is a researcher in psychoanalysis affiliated with the Centre National de Recherche Scientifique. And he also has a second career as a radio host. And he's the author of a number of books. I'll give you the titles in English, though the books are in French. What did I write? Here they are. Freud and Yiddish, the Pre-Analytic Period, for example. He is the editor of several collections on Yiddish and psychoanalysis, one Yiddishkeit and psychoanalysis, Yiddish culture and the unconscious, and his most recent book is called Witzen, Yiddish Wit and the Unconscious. He's already lectured here in Yiddish on Yiddishkeit and Freud, and tonight he will be lecturing on What is Jewish Humor? Exploring Wit and Humor in Freud. So let me not take any more time and turn the microphone over to Dr. Max Cohen.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here and to have this lecture in English. I'll try to speak English. About Jewish humor. Let's begin with a short story. At the end of the war, Hitler was very anxious, so he wanted to speak to his astrologist, and he told him, he asked him, am I going to lose the war? And the astrologist answered, yes sir. Am I going to die? Yes sir. You're going to die, and you are going to die in the Jewish holiday. So Hitler asked, which Jewish holiday? When you're going to die, it's going to be a Jewish holiday. Could be black humor, you know, gallows humor. It's in a book about gallows humor, in fact, in the camps. But this short story, which is quoted by Miriam Shmulevich Hoffman in the foreword, in the Yiddish foreword, is very interesting to analyze. First of all, what does it tell? For everyone, life is very difficult because of the death. Because of death, we're going to die. So we are scared, everyone. We're not only scared by death, we are scared by the end of our life, which can be very painful. So, the real master for many people is death. The Jewish people believe that time is our destiny. We are in time. We have not a lot of time, not so much time, but we live in time. We wait. We wait for Mashiach, means we wait for another story and another story. Never ends. So, one day, there is going to be a story which will be stronger than Mr. Hitler, which will remind everyone that this guy existed but is now dead. This is, on my point of view, one of the most important things in Jewish humor. Means we are a people which does live not only in a space which is absolutely necessary for everyone in the body also, which is absolutely necessary also. We are a human being and we are speaking, we need a space, but we are also living in time. If you take the example of Abraham Heschel, who spoke about the relation between time and the Jewish tradition, it's exactly the same. We are people waiting. And so this story tells it very quickly and very shortly. Now, if we go back to Freud, Sigmund Freud, Schleimer, in fact, Sigmund, is Schleimer, his Hebrew name was Schleimer, Avada, Schleimer Melech. No, Sigmund, how do you go from Schleimer to Sigmund? This is a Jewish joke, I suppose. He never spoke about Jewish humor. There is an article he wrote in 1928 about humor in general, not about Jewish humor. There is only one other, are some others, but there is one very famous in the psychoanalytical circles who wrote a book about Jewish humor. It's one of his friends and student. It's Theodor Reich. Theodor Reich. He was living here in New York. And in fact, in this article in 1928, Freud didn't speak about Jewish humor. Why? This is a question. Does Jewish humor exist or does it not exist? This is a question we can ask. For me, it does exist. I just gave you a sample of this. He has a point of view about humor, which is completely different from his point of view from what he says about the jokes, the wits. He wrote a book in 1905 about jokes and the unconscious. In this book, he quotes a lot of Yiddish jokes, but in fact, they are translated from Yiddish in German. So he doesn't analyze very seriously the language, which is Yiddish. He speaks about Yiddish as a jargon. He's not the only one who is speaking about Yiddish like a jargon. It's only a book which is necessary for him to demonstrate that there are some processes which are exactly the same in the dream and in a wit in general, and not a Jewish one. So, if we go further, we can see that for Freud, when he thinks about humor, it is not at all the same than when he thinks about the wit or the jokes. In the joke, the most important is the other one. He calls it the third person. The third person is someone who has an ear, who is listening to what happens. And this makes the difference. When we speak, there is not always someone who's listening. In a usual conversation, it's not at all natural to listen and to have an ear to what is said. This is unusual. In fact, we think that we listen to people, but we go very quick to what is said, to the meaning of a sentence, and we do not take our time to listen exactly to what is said, which is in fact usually completely different from what is said. Let us take another example of a woman who is calling in the hospital. I'd like some news from Rivka Levy. Rivka Levy, one moment, we give you the administrator, the administration. I'm looking, yes, she feels quite well. She's going home tomorrow. She has been eating twice yesterday. That's wonderful. Are you a relative of Mrs. Levy? No, I am Rivka Levy. But the doctor doesn't tell me anything. Zerbrochte die Juden, haben wir gesagt, in der Spitur. Zerbrochen die Juden, haben wir in der Spitur. I don't have to speak only English now. We are speaking many languages in our tradition. So, it's very difficult when we are in the hospital because everybody has been, and you know perfectly well that you have no news of yourself. So, how do you do? If you ask the nursery or the doctor, the answer yes, no, or lies, or they just escape it. So it's very difficult. So you have here the first meaning, which in the Jewish tradition of the interpretation of the Torah is pshat, push it. Push it means literally. You take the thing literally. Literally, it's absolutely true that it's very difficult to have news of myself when I am in a hospital. So what do I do? I can try to do what Rivka Levy does. It means, I'm not going to say that I'm Rivka Levy, I'm going to say that I'm someone else. Drash. It's elusive. It's not exactly literally. So you take it in another way. Do you think that you are who you are? Do you think I am who I am what I am? It's not sure. Maybe I am what I am, but I am someone else. So if I am too sure to be what I am, it's not sure that I can speak and have news of myself. So I use a stratagem. This is what happens in the story. She says she is someone else. Maybe someone, a relative, that's what the administrator thinks, or she could be anyone. The third meaning is about the word relative. In Yiddish it's kroiv, which comes from Hebrew, karov. Karov, it's near. Rachok, it's far. Kroiv means someone who is very close to me. So it also has a connection, which is not so interesting, but it does exist, with another word, which is kubre, which means prostitute. So if you are in a hospital, you give your body to the science. This is not possible. You want to be the owner of your body till the end. But there is another meaning, which goes to the sort, brings the secret of a story. And I suppose, and I told it in Yiddish last time, that all the psychoanalysis and the process of psychoanalysis has to do with these four levels of interpretation. You never can catch the secret of a human relation. The unconscious is really unconscious on a certain point. That's why Freud told in his book about the dreams in 1900 that the secret of a dream is absolutely impossible to think. You can't catch it. It's exactly the same in a joke. I mean, a joke which is something, which is a story, with someone who listens to the joke and who has a certain interpretation on what is going on. So, let's go to the other meaning of this story. You have Rivka. Rivka, she's in the Bible. She's in the Bible. She's someone who was married. She didn't decide of her marriage. Isaac was her man, but he was not chosen by her. Abraham wanted his son to be married, so he sent someone to pray. And she was there, and she was attracted by the man praying, and so she was talking to him. And that's the story. Not only that, there is also another point which is important in the Bible about Rivka. when she preferred Yaakov and not Esav. So she told to Isaac to pray, and that he was praying about Yaakov and not Esav. But Esav came after, and so Isaac saw it, and Esav was very furious of it, and Isaac also. So she's used to say some lies. You see, if you take a short story, you don't have to know all the Torah, you don't have to know all the Jewish tradition necessarily. But the most important is inside. Very shortly, you have different points of interpretation of a story. And this is, to my opinion, one of the most important things in the jokes. If you take now humor, humor is not connected for Freud to someone who is listening a story. He makes a big difference between joke and humor in general. There is another question we can ask. Do different people have really humor? Do Chinese or German have humor? What is a different kind of humor? This is a real question. What is humor? So we have to know what is humor on a psychoanalytical point of view, and Freud tells us what it is for him. It's a conflict for him between ego and superego. So we think that we can be stronger than our superego. And so it's like a child who is connected with his father. It is exactly what he says. A child who says to his father, "See, I'm stronger than you. You tell me there is a law, I don't have to go with mother, I don't have to sleep with her." But this is not true, and consciously it's not true for me, even if you say it. I'm stronger than you. I'm stronger than the law. In Jewish tradition, what is the point? We have 613 mitzvahs. Impossible. 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 So, well, how do you make? Like everyone, we make what we can, or nothing, or just a little, or just a little more. So we just have relation to the law, which is complicated, because we know there is one, but we are not the law. It has been given by someone else, which we call God. Anyhow, we are not the law, and we are not in the position to make everything which is requested. So we know there is something which is impossible. And this is very important for a human being in general, the relation to the law, knowing that it does exist. There is a limit to us, which is given by someone else, maybe the father, whatever. And this is a difference between joke and humor in general for Freud. Means there is a connection to the law and to the superego in the humor. And we can understand another point now, that in Jewish humor, one of the point, the punch points in Jewish humor is a possibility to not only to play with death, as I told about the story concerning Hitler, but to play also with the possibility of not being Jewish. This is very important, because most of the people don't want. It's too complicated. More than half of the Jewish people doesn't want to be Jewish. And this has always been the same. But a little less, a little more, depends. But the conflict inside everyone does exist. So we allow us, we give us the freedom to play with the possibility of not being Jewish. So that's why you have many stories which do concern conversions. Someone is tried, has a trial, and he has a death sentence, and before the death sentence, it's a Jew, he wanted to convert to Christianity. So he was asked why. He said, I don't want a Jew to be killed. That's typical. So, you convert, you say you're no more Jews, but we know you are. And not only that, you don't really believe in your conversion. In your conversion. It's true for the Naranos, it's true for lots of people. Even in France we had Jean-Marie Lustiger. He spoke Yiddish, and there was a Kaddish when he died outside Notre Dame, and he said he was also Christian. So there is a contradiction, but it's not outside only, it's inside. So all these problems which are created by anti-Semitism and the history of Judaism are very important to us, because we need a certain freedom where people like the others, and we want also the possibility of not being Jewish. So I think Jewish humor is the possibility, in a certain way, not to be Jewish a certain time, which is not so long, the time of a few stories. And afterwards, we will remain, but quite in a different way. So, it's a certain freedom that we have to play with our identity, which is too difficult at certain times. If you suffer too much, if you think all this behavior, religious behavior and so on, are not at all interesting, so you don't want anymore to deal with it. There is another point, which is not only playing with death and being in time, playing with the Jewish identity, which is in the time, but it's also playing with languages. And this is very important also. It has to do with Yiddish. But you cannot think about Yiddish only as Yiddish. You have to think about all the Yiddish, the Jewish languages in general. Because all the Jewish languages in general, and there are plenty of them, Judaismo, and Judeo-French, and so Judeo-Italian, Judeo-Greek, and so on, are languages which are completely invented between the language of the law and the language of the outside and of the state. It's important to have a language which is between, in between, the language of power and the language of law. Because we cannot live in the law, in the language of the law, all the time. To understand what is written in Hebrew, we need another language. Because to understand the language, we need another language. Translation is absolutely necessary to understand what we say. That's why the Jewish people has always been a people with many languages. Hebrew, modern Hebrew, and I learned Hebrew for 10 years now, so I knew it as a favorite, aval lo rak ivrit. I think we need this many languages. So the Yiddish language is an invention. It is a creation. There is a little story, someone who is in a class. A teacher asks a model to go to show on the map where are the United States of America. So he shows it here, and the teacher asks the other students, so now, who discovered America? And the students say, Model. So what does this story tell? All those stories are in my new book about Yiddish Witzen, which are from the fallers of Yiddish. They are in Yiddish, it's printed in Yiddish. I gave some people a paper, a flyer about it, and it's printed in Yiddish and explained. It's in French, unfortunately for you if you don't speak French. So it's explained and translated in French. But the foreword as Ruchel Scherter, who collects some Yiddish jokes, and some of them are really very interesting because they are modern. It's extremely interesting to translate and to think about. And I have to say that I think that the Jewish Yiddish joke is like a session of psychoanalysis. I don't say it is a psychoanalysis, absolutely not. In any case, it's not true. But it is like a session because you come with all what you think, your ideology, your representations, and you go out with something else which has changed because someone has listened to your story. And if in your life it happens that someone listens really to what you say, it changes the things. So all this is very important in psychoanalysis, which is a long process, and I work as a psychoanalyst in my office for 30 years now, so it's not something which I do for a few months. It's very long, and I saw it work. It works sometimes, not always, of course, but it does work. It's rather complicated, both for the patient and for the psychoanalyst. But I think the Yiddish joke, if you take it and you think about it, it's like a session of psychoanalysis. So it took me in my office a few hours to understand, not everything, but to understand a little in a story. Let's come back to the story of Motel. There is a psychoanalyst whose name is Winnicott. He's English. He was English. He's dead now. Donald Woods Winnicott. He said very clinically that the child believes that he creates his mother. When he finds his mother, he does create her. So this is very important. A child, a small child, not a so old one, a baby, thinks that he creates not only his mother, but the world, everything. And we are still, as elderly people, in this belief that we create the world and what does exist. And this is true for languages. We know in all the Jewish languages, and especially in Yiddish, but not only, that a language is not given by the state and by God. It's not true. We know that we have to create a language ourselves. So this is a point which is very important, because in this position of creating the language among people who have this almost the same history, it's something which is common to many people. So when you make a joke, it's not only something which happens between a few people, it happens also between generations, in a whole history which is complicated, in different languages, because we need all the time to create a language in which we can live. So one language is a mistake, any language, English, Hebrew, whatever. The people who speak, actually, almost everyone, not everyone, but almost, Yiddish only, it's impossible. All the people who were killed and spoke Yiddish, they were speaking Yiddish between many other languages. The people who remain who speak Yiddish are speaking different languages. It is impossible to be in only one language. The identification to one language is impossible. This is also a point which is important in Jewish humor. So you can see that in Jewish humor you have different ways to deal with death, with life, with time, with language, with the Jewish identity, which is also something which is very complicated. And it is a certain freedom that we have to survive. So, without this humor, And it can be different from time to time. It is extremely different from before the Shoah now, but it because it was a huge disaster, so it was very difficult to laugh about it. But even in the camps, there were jokes, and there are some books about it, and even people who you know certainly, and I know also, told me jokes about what happened in the camps. So even in those terrible situations, you have this freedom of not only of laughing, it's a question of playing with all what I told you. It means with time, with death, with identity, with language. So now, is really Jewish humor a fact? Does it exist really? Is it absolutely different from other kinds of humor? And how can we think about that? Of course, it's different, and it's difficult to explain, because how can we say that people do not have humor? It's a point of view that we can have, but is it really true? For example, if we say that Germans, I've heard it, Germans don't have humor. So I don't know if it's absolutely true, but it's completely different. I'll take an example of a sample of it. I wrote a book 22 years ago. I was the first time here in New York. It was about the stories of Chen. You know, the town of simple people, simple-minded people. In fact, they are very intelligent, and it's a terrible story, because where you're too much intelligent, you become stupid. The word is not so Talmudic like they are. You know, you can't play with the word like they do, and so they become completely stupid. They have no pragmatism, and so on. So there is a whole tradition of towns, of stupid people also in Great Britain. The name is Gotham. And in Germany, it's Schilda. And if you read the stories of Gotham, they are in the tradition of English humor, which is the nonsense. Understatement and nonsense. I made a lecture about Jewish humor in the neighborhood in London, and the English people who don't speak at all English, Yiddish, I mean. Don't speak at all Yiddish over there. I've been told that people told them that they were in the United States when they arrived over there. So because they listened to English, so they stood there. They thought it was it's a story. Anyway, so it's understatement and nonsense. This is a kind of humor. English humor is a kind of humor which does exist. If you take the stories of stupid people in Germany, of Gotham, it's not at all the same than the nonsense of the English humor. It is completely different. So you can take also another example which I studied, I speak about it in the book also. It's the humor of the Zen humor, then Zen literature in Buddhism, which are very interesting stories. You have a lot of stories, not every story, but it's the same in the Jewish stories, are very, very interesting. For example, a master asks his student, what is the void? The void. Nothing. The void. And the student begins to speak and to speak about the void. And the master takes his nose and he pushes it like that. And the student says, because he cannot breathe anymore. Now, I do understand what is void. So you see, if you begin with a representation, an ideology of something, it is very difficult. You have to get out of it. So how do you do? You can tell some stories. You can create a situation. You can create also a situation in connection with languages, which is a situation which does open something of a movement, a change in your relation to your representation. It's the same with Rivka Levi. Does Rivka Levi really think after the story that she is Rivka Levi? Because she had to say that she was the Rivka of the Bible, that she was someone who was simply ill in a hospital, and after all those stories she could say that she was the real Rivka Levi. So Jewish humor does exist. It has time. It's a way to play with our identity. It's a possibility of freedom, not to be Jewish a certain while, but to remain Jewish after the story. It's a possibility to play with death. Of course, it can be a mythology, because who can really play with death? Because death is stronger than anything. But what do we believe? Do we believe that life is stronger than death? This is not the point. We believe that time is stronger than anything. We don't have much time, but there is something which will remain a little more than our own life. And this is a collective story. So Jewish humor is not only individual, it's also a collective story in our history. That's what I wanted to tell you. No, there are different jokes, you know. It can be. Yes. Yes,
Paul. Well, said sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, it's a jug, and sometimes just a jug.
I didn't understand. I'm sorry.
We are told in English,
yes,
that Freud at one point said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Is sometimes a joke just a joke?
Why not?
And how do you know?
Now, this is complicated. Yes, sometimes it's just a joke. So it's what he says about the pleasure in the joke. A joke, it's the same about humor. He says humor, it is a possibility to have a certain pleasure in a complicated situation when we suffer too much. It's a possibility to get some pleasure, even if there is some suffering. So, most of the jokes and most of the humor is connected with this possibility of pleasure. That's what he says. So it's just a joke. But sometimes it goes further. That's what I wanted to tell. So he tells a lot about this. So it's not only the pleasure which is the point. It's also to change, to see the world in a different way. But there are plenty of jokes, and absolutely, which are limited to pleasure. It's just a joke, and it's excellent. We appreciate it. Yes. But sometimes, if you think about it, it goes further. A cigar is a cigar, but it can be something else sometimes. Groucho Marx, a cigar of Freud, is a cigar. You've got cancer, but Groucho Marx has a different cigar. I wouldn't say it's the same. No, it's funny in his mouth. It looks funny. It's an example. So it's a different way of speaking to some people, having a cigar. He had some pictures in the New York Times this morning about the President of the United States were smoking. Clinton was smoking cigars. It's different from a pipe or a cigarette with Kennedy and so on. So it's a way of speaking to the other. Can be also something which has a meaning. I don't know. Yes?
When you were speaking about the people of film, it made me think of Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels. And Swift, he wrote in English, but he was Irish. And I was wondering if, and the Irish suffered a lot, and I was wondering if it's connected to the spring of the use? Do you think that there's possibly a relation there?
Maybe, but you know, the difference with Chelm, that is in one point. There are some writers who wrote stories. I translated the book of someone from New York, Salomon Simon, who was living here. His son was also living here. He was a dentist, but he wrote books in Yiddish. But he collected some collective stories, which were told generation after generation, and there is no real writer of these stories, you see. It's the same about Yiddish jokes. You have books who collect Yiddish jokes, many, Havnitsky, many, 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 but you couldn't say that someone precisely created them. But what you say about Swift and the Irish background of suffering is very interesting. Concerning Chelm, I think the difference is that they try to escape a painful situation, which is that the word is not a text. We are not always studying the Talmud. So if you try to transfer the way you behave with the text to the way you connect to the word in the modern life, you have many problems. But they try to keep something in the middle, you see. But there is a connection with a painful situation, because the word is not a text. Reality is reality. A cigar is only a cigar. An Irishman is only an Irishman. And a Jew is sometimes only a Jew. It's a human being, which is a lot. Yes?
Did Freud speak Yiddish?
Well, there is a point that we have to remain. His parents, his mother came from Galicia, from a town called Brody, which is a Yiddish-speaking town. The Brody singers were very, very famous over there. His father from Tizmenitz, which is also a Yiddish-speaking town. And then when they came to Vienna, they spoke German, but they spoke, according to Freeman, who was a Theodor Reich, a friend of Freud, says that Amalia spoke Yiddish to Freud. I wouldn't say that Freud spoke Yiddish, no. But I wouldn't say also, neither, that he didn't understand at all. It means there is a connection inside himself, like for many immigrants. But it's different when you immigrate from a Yiddish-speaking town like Tizmenitz or Galicia to Vienna or to Berlin in a German context, because you speak very, very quickly German, but it is with Yiddish words and Yiddish accent. So he hasn't, I wouldn't say he spoke it. He quotes a lot of Jewish Yiddish words in his work, and it is present, to my opinion, in all his work. So I think from Freud, not only as a human being, but also as a complicated process, which is also psychological, linguistical, and sociological. That's my opinion.
How did he speak to his parents then?
I think he spoke German with his parents, but maybe sometime. I don't know if he spoke Yiddish. I was not there. I have only... No. I suppose he understood a little, but he didn't speak it usually like mother tongue. This is not my opinion, but I think he heard it. And even in Vienna, there were many Yiddish speakers, so he was in a place where it was alive in a certain point of view. But it is not the most important. The most important is that Freud himself is a point in the history of this Yiddish language in Eastern Europe. He is one point in it. And I always say that if you want to understand the jokes, you don't have to understand what Freud is telling about the Yiddish jokes, but to understand what the Yiddish jokes are making of Freud. This is my point.
Dr. Richard, my understanding of the consensus is that his mother only spoke Yiddish. He went to see her every Sunday morning. He was a good son. He spoke to her in Yiddish.
Maybe.
And this is what is in the literature, and supposedly someone who says that that is the case. Now, if that is the case, and I think it is, of course there is a question about why he denied that he understood Yiddish. He denied that he knew Hebrew, although he was exposed to Hebrew, and his father gave him a Hebrew inscription, the Bible, and would a father give someone a Hebrew inscription to a person who couldn't read Hebrew? So, I mean, I think there was a very complicated, issue.
Sure.
Freud's attitude toward Yiddish and Hebrew and being Jewish, which, as they say, is an under the ganze Meister.
It's important. You're absolutely right. I don't know exactly what happened during his childhood. I read something. But we have to speak about his relation to Judaism, to being Jew. He was scared that the psychoanalysis could be only Jewish. He told it. It's not a Jewish science. It sounds like a denial, because everyone was Jewish except Jung. The patients were Jewish, the students were Jewish. Of course, he was not completely wrong, because if there is a science, why should we say that it is a Jewish science? But his position was very clear. He didn't want to show too much that it was so Jewish. And Karl Luger, the mayor of Wien, was anti-Semitic. So he was clearly scared about all this. And so what reminds him something which is Jewish too much is dangerous. It's true for Yiddish, it's true for Hebrew, it's true for Moshe Rabbeinu, because at the end of his life he writes a book where he says that Moshe Rabbeinu is not Jewish, he's Egyptian. Another story. So all this is very important. I think that after the Shoah we have to think it over. We don't have to be so scared, but anyway we have enemies, and they are like Hitler and so on. So we. I don't know why we should be scared to be Jewish, because if we want to be, if we don't not want to be, okay, I respect it. But if we want to be, it means we think it's worse if we are not. Because what Jewish humor says, it is horrible to be Jewish. You see, you have a Hitler. That's a story I told in the beginning. You have a guy like that. He's stronger like than you. He killed almost all people. So, what pleasure do you have in it? Yes, okay. But if you go further, if you go on, it's an extraordinary chance in life to understand the text with different meanings, a relationship between human beings in different ways, and to know that there is a secret we can never get, but we have to speak and speak and wait. So this is also interesting. It's not only a malediction. Heinrich Heine in the Reisebilder, which is quoted by Freud in his book about the Jewish joke, says being Jewish is a malediction. It's a nightmare. No, he was converted. So I think Freud has a complicated relation to his tradition, but he remains Jewish. He says it at the Maybrit in 1926. His brother read the text which he has written. He says, what connects me to Judaism is not religion, it's not Zionism. It's a deep feeling of a common identity and something which is close in the representation, in the psychic representation we have, which is completely common between us. What is it? Someone, when I made the lecture in Yiddish, told it was the Torah. You remember? So maybe, I don't know. But now, after the Shoah, it's different. I think it's completely different. For some people, not for everyone. But Yiddish is present in psychoanalysis. It doesn't depend on Mr. Freud himself. He's not necessarily the one who can speak the best of it, but he is not completely deaf. Yes?
American Yiddish humor comes from my experience. It's almost exclusively from the Eastern European Jewish origins. Is there a similar humor, say, from Latino or even German Jews, or is the latter an oxymoron?
No, this is an Ashkenazic story. When I read some books about Judaismo humor, because Ladino is the transcription of Hebrew Torah in Castilian. So there is one, I know him, Chaim Vidal Sefija, he's a teacher of Ladino. He makes a difference between Ladino and Judaismo. Judaismo is what is spoken. Ladino is only the transcription. But there are some nice stories in Judaismo, which are... there is some stories about a guy who is stupid also. Not a whole town like Chen, but there are some stories which are very nice, you know. But it's completely different. But there is a connection. I think there is a connection. It is not only something which is important for the Jewish tradition, it's also important in general. Is there anything common between human beings or not? Are we only different cultures and that's all? Or do we have something in common? Our relation to death, to birth, to language, to sex, to food, things like that. And all the anthropology things. But there is something common. So we don't have, I do think so. But there are different cultures also, which means that if, in an Ashkenazic tradition transplanted here in America, you created, that's what I did want to say, but I didn't say it. It's always the most important you don't say. But the story of Model, the American Jews created America. Not the real America, but an imaginary America, in part, in the movies and in the life. It was a dream. It has been a nightmare also for many people. It's still for many people a nightmare. It's not so easy. But it was something which has completely been created by people. And the Jews also created something. And they transplanted the Yiddish humor from Eastern Europe in a new land, in a new country, and created an American Jewish humor, of course, which is not necessarily speaking Yiddish. But if I think it's important to remind that there is also a Yiddish tradition in that. That's what you say also. Yes?
How different is Hebrew humor from Yiddish humor?
It depends. If you take Ephraim Kishon, this is funny. But nowadays, it's different. You don't have this kind of humor which concerns immigrants who are in camps coming from Eastern Europe after the war and trying to become Israelis and speaking very bad Hebrew. You know, there are some movies about Ephraim Kishon, which is very, very funny. And he wrote a lot of novels and so on, short stories. But, you know, Hebrew humor today is not a humor which has to deal with the diaspora. In fact, in Hebrew, you are in a different situation. You have humor like when you are in a country where you have a language of the state and a country in war. So you have a lot of jokes which concerns a difficult situation of a country in war. That's all. It is not so connected with all this tradition. In my opinion, what I saw when I was in Israel and what I read, it's not connected with all tradition of knowing that where you are, it's not exactly the place. It can be, but it's just the place. So don't worry so much. You know, it's in war, but it's complicated. Yes.
We're all speaking about humor and about humor, isn't he really talking about like, the unconscious in terms of avoidance of unpleasure? So the avoidance of pain, and it does connect in a sense to death because of the fear of death and the fear of the inevitable or the or pain.
No, you're right. You're right. He speaks about pleasure, but in fact he speaks about suffering.
Yes.
Sure. But there is a certain possibility to suffer in another way after the story. You don't have the same connection with your suffering.
That's it. But also the jokes are really the release of the tension of the unpleasant.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what he says. You're absolutely right. Yes. Yes.
Some years ago, one of my colleagues said that there are no Jewish jokes about sex. All the jokes that are ostensibly about sex are really about money. And I'm not pursuing this as a scholarly interest, so I was wondering if you could say something about that.
No, there are some jokes about sex. You know, I go for 1 year and a half in a French cafe, which is in Place de la République, where all Jews are speaking Yiddish. I made some interviews over there, but I began interviews for SBS Radio in Australia, Yiddish Radio in Australia, in this cafe. Very funny people. All Jews, somewhere in Auschwitz, somewhere in the Gulag, somewhere in the Polish army, in the Russian army, whatever. Yeah. Jewish people, so. But they, after a while, because I came over there a long time, and they told me a lot of jokes about sex, and I wasn't used to it, because I when you read a book of Jewish humor, you don't have a lot of that, you see. So you have stories about money, of course, but you have about sex. Even homosexuality can be joked. So it does exist. It makes you feel the thing different. There is something else which is important, I didn't say it. There is a guy who is called Empatiba. Empatiba is from Mali. He wrote a book about his story as a child, and he was in the UNESCO, United Nations, and so on. And he says that in Mali, there is, when you make a joke, a whole tradition of solidarity between people. It means it's never serious. You're not going to kill the other one. You're not going to have sex with him or to get his money. It's just a way of talking, because there is no pleasure in life. It's exactly the same with what was told before. So this tradition of solidarity, which does exist in Mali, is absolutely the same in the old tradition of Yiddish jokes, because telling a joke, even if there is a certain aggressivity in it against the other one, means the other Jew also, because he wants my money, he wants to have sex, he wants, like everyone, to have everything. It's just for fun. It's just for fun. It's not real. And if there is a Hitler, we can also find some jokes about it. It means we do know it does exist, but it's possible to create some stories about it and to go ahead. That's what I think. Yes?
You know, if you observe in everyday interactions between people, their humor is used to dissipate anxiety, to dissipate fear, to deal with life as it is. And so that's not a joke, it's an interaction that goes on, but some people are very good at finding that certain place which helps to dissipate whatever it is that's going on.
It's true, it's true.
And I once had a book which I didn't read, unfortunately, and gave away, but this is years ago, where this was the humor of different nationalities, where humor was culturally conditioned. And so I don't remember what German was in there, and I guess I didn't read the book, but I think they Scandinavian, and I think you mentioned Chinese or Tibetan.
But you have also humor in the
yes,
in Eastern Europe, between non-Jews, you had humor during the Stalinistic period. You know, when there was the Cold War and there was Stalin, there were a lot of jokes in Czechoslovakia and so many countries. So you have in Kundera, you have a kind of humor also. And it does exist. I mean, when it's too difficult, people try to escape. So they need to make something. And it's not typically Jewish. What makes it Jewish is what I tried to explain. It's that it's not a question of a story only. We are a collective people. And when we invent a story, it's in a whole story. It has to go to generation, from one generation to one generation. When you speak Yiddish, it's not only someone who speaks with another one. It's one generation who speaks to another one, which is not there. I made an interview of Moshe Yasur a few days ago about Gimpel Tam, and he told me exactly the same. Where is the audience of a Yiddish theater today in Auschwitz? It's very few. It's like that. It's not because Mr. Moshe Yasur or Shmuel Atzmon, I spoke with him also, are not good. They do what they can, but the audience is missing. So we have another problem after the Chorban, after the Shoah. It means when you speak, you don't speak only one to the other. One generation wants to speak to the other one. Life has to be stronger, and time is our space in a certain point of view. But other people invented also this. I think in Zen humor, there is something which is completely common with Jewish humor, to my point of view. This is something I discovered. I like it very much. I like extremely much Zen humor. But Kundera, he was joking during Stalin, you know. Milan Kundera, and so on.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
So, thank you to the audience for attending. And if you're not on the mailing list and you'd like to be, there are sign-up sheets outside. We encourage you to sign up. And a word from our sponsor. The next evening lecture will be Wednesday, January 28th, 2009. Yes, it's a new year coming up. And that will be a fellowship lecture. It will be